And to US sentiments running high across Iranian cities as people rally to mark the day when students took over the US embassy 42 years ago.
We are in conducting the operation.
Iran releases the footage of blocking a recent attempt by US forces to seize a tanker that was carrying Iranian oil in the Sea of Oman. Plus, a top US general giving assurances of the Pentagon power to defend Taiwan from an attack by China if asked to do so. Welcome to World News from Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Well, today is a very important day in Iran's history. It's named the National Day Against Global Arrogance, and Iranians commemorate the occasion by holding rallies to condemn US policies. Right now, crowds of people have started gathering on the streets in different cities in a show of their anger at the US atrocities directed at their country over the past four decades. In the capital, Tehran, the protesters are gathering just outside a building that was used to be the U.S. Embassy before the Islamic Revolution. 42 years ago, on this day, a group of students, university students, I should say, took over the embassy building amidst anti-U.S. anger. Traditionally, on this day, chants against the U.S. can be heard from protesters who support resistance against Washington's plots. Now, since the 1979 takeover of the compound, Iranians have been marking the occasion every year by holding rallies. Our correspondent Saman Kujuri has been on the ground covering this year's rallies for us. He joined us earlier to explain what these annual protests signify and why they're important.
Today, this is of course a routine for every year that people get together and indeed mark the day in order to every year to show that they are still angry at the U.S. hegemonic policies, and they want to the U.S. to stop its hegemonic policies and also domineering policies in the past 42 years, not just against the Islamic Republic of Iran, but in general throughout the world. Because, as you might know, in the past 100 years, history shows that the United States has been active in different countries and has tried to topple the establishments of different countries, almost 60 countries worldwide. And according to experts, if 42 years ago, back in 1979, the students and Iranian students had not taken over the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, the nascent Islamic Republic of Iran they would have been derailed. So actually the move by the Iranian students back in 1979 somehow guaranteed the stability and the security and the survival of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the Islamic Revolution of Iran in those days.
Iran has released footage showing how it thwarted a U.S. attempt to steal an Iranian oil shipment in the Sea of Oman. The naval forces of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps steered the captured vessel toward Iran's territorial waters after a confrontation with U.S. forces.
We are conducting the operation.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps released a video on Wednesday which showed how its naval force foiled a recent U.S. attempt to steal a shipment of Iranian oil in the Sea of Oman. The IRGC said the Americans seized a tanker and transferred its cargo to another vessel to divert it to an unknown destination. The IRGC forces, however, managed to land on the deck of the second tanker and diverted it into Iran's territorial waters. U.S. forces unsuccessfully attempted to block the tanker's path using helicopters and warships. They also made another failed attempt to seize the tanker from entering the Iranian waters. The ship later docked in Bandar Abbas port on October the 25th.
This is an American invasion, a hostile action against Iranian interests. This would definitely escalate the tensions, but the purpose of such moves is very much clear, as Iran has been practicing practicing resistance diplomacy to resist against the United States pressures, illegal sanctions.
The U.S. has been trying to prevent Iran from selling its oil since former President Donald Trump pledged to bring the country's crude exports to zero. This toes the lines of the so-called maximum pressure campaign Trump launched in 2018 following his unilateral withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal. Last year, the Trump administration also threatened to deploy the U.S. Navy to the Caribbean Sea to stop Iran from delivering fuel shipments to Venezuela, but it failed to do so. Recently, when Iran began exporting fuel to Lebanon, the U.S. again vowed to impede the effort, but to no avail. Iran has time and again warned against U.S. adventurism in the West Asian region. Iranian officials say Tehran does not seek to get involved in a conflict with Washington, but will give a firm and crushing response to any military action. The recent confrontation in the Sea of Oman has highlighted Iran's military might and conveyed a message to the White House that the Iranian armed forces will not hesitate to defend the country and its interests.
Well, Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi there has slammed the United States piracy following that incident. He has also praised the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps' naval forces for foiling the U.S. military's attempt to essentially take and steal that Iranian oil in the Sea of Oman. Latest comments there by Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi on that incident that was announced yesterday by the country. Now, Iran's deputy foreign minister says talks with the parties to the 2015 nuclear deal will resume on November the 29th, and the negotiations are aimed at removing sanctions the U.S. imposed on Iran after abandoning the accord in 2018. Ali Bagheri Karni has announced the date after a phone call with Enrique Mora, the European Union's political director. Mora acts as the coordinator of the Joint Commission of Iran's nuclear deal, known as the JCPOA. Iran and the remaining JCPOA signatories have so far held six rounds of talks in Vienna this year. They have discussed ways to salvage the agreement that has been unraveling since the U.S.'s unilateral withdrawal. Washington, that wants to rejoin the deal, now says it's possible to resolve outstanding issues within a short time frame.
We believe it remains possible to quickly reach and implement an understanding on a mutual return to compliance with the JCPOA by closing the relatively small number of issues that remained outstanding at the end of June when the sixth round concluded. We believe that if the Iranians are serious, we can manage to do that in relatively short order.
In the meantime, Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, has warned that the upcoming talks will break down unless the U.S. guarantees it will never walk away from the nuclear deal again. Iran says it is ready to go back to full compliance with the pact if all other parties do so in a verifiable manner. Political commentator Heinz Gartner says both the U.S. and the EU should offer Iran guarantees for a long-term commitment to the nuclear deal. Here he is.
Of course, the Iranians want that all sanctions would be removed. I think that's a stumbling block because the U.S. will keep some of the sanctions. They will want to keep some leverage. And I understand also that for Iran, it's not only an economic issue, it's an issue of pride as well. So I do think it is possible. Of course, the other stumbling block is that the Iranians, what is very understandable, because the U.S. withdrew unilaterally from the deal, the Iranians want a guarantee for the next president in the U.S. That he will not or she will not leave the deal. That's hard to do for an American president to promise this because he doesn't have the support. But there are other possibilities. For example, in the rest of the Biden administration, the Iran can conclude long-term contracts with companies for 10 years or something, which go beyond the next administrations. And I have to say, the Europeans should give the guarantee to the Iranians if the United States would withdraw, that the Europeans would stay in the deal. So I haven't heard this from the Europeans, but that would be a good move if the Europeans could do so.
China is reacting to a visit by a European delegation to Taiwan. Beijing says Europe needs to correct its mistakes and not send any wrong signals to the self-ruled island. A group of European Parliament officials are now visiting Taiwan for the first time. In a meeting with President Tsai Ing-wen, the head of the delegation has assured her that, quote, Taipei is not alone and that Europe is standing with it. China often advises Western governments, particularly Washington, against growing relations with Taipei. In fresh comments, the chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, has said there's no question that the U.S. military is capable of defending Taiwan against a future attack by China. The top general says he does not expect China to wage a war to take control of Taiwan anytime soon, and that Washington wants to see a peaceful settlement to the dispute. China sees Taiwan as its own territory, but Taiwan wants independence and says it's ready to defend itself if there is an armed conflict. And the Pentagon says a U.S. drone strike that killed 10 civilians in Kabul back in August did not violate any law. The U.S. Defense Department says its investigation has found that the attack was caused by a series of errors, including the interpretation of intelligence. Lieutenant General Sami Saeed, who headed the probe, has called the attack a regrettable mistake. The strike came days after a Daesh bombing killed 13 American troops and scores of Afghan civilians outside Kabul airport gates. The Pentagon had initially said the strike targeted a Daesh bomber who posed an imminent threat to U.S.-led troops. The deputy chief of Hezbollah says Saudi Arabia's recent approach towards Lebanon is meant to divert attention from its failure in the Yemen war. Sheikh Naim Qasim says the resistance movement will not allow Saudi Arabia to interfere in Lebanon's political affairs, including the formation of its cabinet. Qasim also says the kingdom has shown in numerous ways that it opposes Hezbollah's presence in the Lebanese government. He has urged Riyadh to apologize to Beirut for what he calls immoral moves. The comments seem to be in response to the Saudi Arabian foreign minister, who has said dealing with Lebanon is pointless due to Hezbollah's dominance in the country. Well, we've reached out to political commentator Edward Corrigan for comment on this. He tells us that Saudi Arabia is obviously embarrassed by its failure in the war it's leading on Yemen, and is therefore trying to paint a picture that Riyadh is the leader of the Arab world.
The Saudis are losing the war in Yemen, and this is no doubt a very big embarrassment, so they have to lash out and attack other people to try to make it appear that they are the leader of the Arab world and they have the power, when in fact only they're dividing the Arab world, and in fact dividing the Islamic world. The Americans, the Israelis want the Arabs to fight amongst themselves, to divide themselves, to weaken themselves, destroy themselves. And you know, the Saudis are buying into this game. As long as the Arabs fight Arabs, they'll always be weak, they'll always be easy to dominate.
104 years has now passed since the day the Balfour Declaration was issued. The controversial declaration by the then UK government is believed to be the precursor for over a century and of oppression and colonization of Palestine. Next, hashtag trending brings you social media's take on the story and more.
Hey everyone, I'm Ali Reza. November the 2nd marks the 104th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration, which set in motion the terrible events that eventually led up to the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians in 1948. Stick around to see some social media reactions to this all. Towards the end of World War I, and with the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire looking more imminent, the then UK government, which was looking for support with its war efforts, played the Semitism card and said it would back the establishment of a home for the Jews, and hence the Balfour Declaration. Therefore, the document is widely seen as the precursor to the 1948 Palestinian Nakba, or catastrophe. the Nakba is the forced exodus of more than 750,000 Palestinians from their homes. But that's only one of the numerous crimes committed against Palestinian people that seek their roots in the Balfour Declaration. All right, let's hit our comments board and see some of your reactions. Mo'min Baraka wrote, 104 years have passed since the ominous Balfour Declaration. The crimes committed and still being committed against our Palestinian people will not be an obstacle to our struggle for our full rights. Rights will not be lost or forgotten by the statute of limitation. Faris wrote, the Balfour Declaration is the precursor to the 1948 Palestinian Nakba, when Zionist armed groups who were trained by the British forcibly expelled more than 750,000 Palestinians from their homeland. Our next tweet comes from Bir Hekaya. They wrote, the imperialistic Balfour Declaration set the stage for a century of colonization and oppression. Exactly. Almost no day goes by without a Palestinian being shot at, savagely beaten, unlawfully imprisoned, or forced to leave their homes by the Israeli forces. And that's been going on for decades, and largely due to the whims of a monarchy. Our next comment comes from Sarah Ray. She wrote, 104 years since the Balfour Declaration, 104 years of suffering. Palestine is not for sale, and Britain did not have the right to give Palestine to any other people. Our next tweet comes from Mohammed Najjar. He wrote, Britain must realize the enormity of the crime it has committed. It has infringed upon the ownership of others, brought home our homeland, gave us a torn tent, and gave Israel a false, vanquished, and defeated state. Palestine Action tweeted, local school kids and the Bristol community came out in droves outside Israel's arms factory HQ. Central operations for Elbit systems remain occupied. Hashtag shut Elbit down. And that is going to be it for this edition of Hashtag Trending. Until next time, take care and bye-bye.
That wraps up our bulletin. Thank you for staying tuned.
Range of programs, spirituality, youth, Eastern tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Tourism, in the name of God, Salam and welcome to the 15th episode of our series Health Tourism. In this program, we are going to focus on cosmetic or aesthetic surgery in Iran and those medical tourists who want to improve their appearance using plastic or cosmetic surgery. Please stay with us. One of the characteristics and innate desires of human beings. Just about everyone wants to look beautiful, and this is one of the important reasons why many people spend a lot of time and money to improve their looks and become more beautiful, and this can lead to cosmetic surgery. Plastic surgery is performed in the world for the purpose of repair or beauty and consists of two types: invasive and minimally invasive. The aggressive type includes liposuction, rhinoplasty, blepharoplasty, abdominoplasty, etc. Among the types of minimally invasive surgeries that are very popular in the world, we can mention Botox injection, filler injection, fat injection, laser hair removal, and macrodermabrasion. Global statistics show that over the past 20 years, consumers of cosmetics and applicants for cosmetic surgery have increased by 80%. According to International Society of Aesthetic Plastic Surgery, that is ISAPS, the United States has the highest rate of cosmetic surgery, followed by Brazil and Japan. Based on the number of surgeries performed in the world, it should be said that 12% of surgeries in the world are performed in these three countries. According to available statistics, the demand for cosmetic surgery is higher among women in a way that more than 85% of cosmetic surgeries are demanded by women. But men are not far behind in cosmetic surgery. The most popular surgeries among men are eyelid surgery, rhinoplasty, liposuction, and hair transplantation. In every country, the type of surgery varies according to the culture of that country. For example, in South Korea and Japan, eyelid surgery or blepharoplasty is the highest demanded surgery, since the people of these countries prefer to have eyes similar to Westerners. Among Iranians, rhinoplasty is the most popular cosmetic surgery, followed by oral and maxillofacial surgeries. Injections, lift and liposuction surgeries, which are considered the main cosmetic surgeries in Iran. However, in terms of the number of different types of surgeries, Iran stands at the 20th place in the world. The interest for rhinoplasty among Iranians has caused local physicians to become the best and most experienced doctors in rhinoplasty in the world. And thus, Iran is known as the capital of rhinoplasty in the world. In the following, we will talk more about rhinoplasty surgery in Iran. Iran is known as one of the leading countries in the West Asia region in the field of cosmetic surgery. The high quality of cosmetic surgery services in Iran and the low cost of providing these services compared to developed countries have paved the way for the development of medical and health tourism in Iran. In recent years, Iran has been able to rank 17th in the world in the field of medical sciences and first in West Asia, which has caused health tourists from different countries to come to Iran for various surgeries, especially cosmetic surgeries. It should be noted that cosmetic surgeries or plastic surgeries are not always performed to make a person more beautiful. Rather, in many cases, these surgeries help those people who have defects in their face and limbs to recover and return to their normal life, and this is one of the great achievements of medical science. The history of plastic surgery in Iran dates back to about 9 years ago, when Dr. Ali Ehsanlu went to the United States to undergo plastic and reconstructive surgery courses, and after returning to Iran, he began teaching and working in this field. he established a department called Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery at the University of Tehran and performed the first cosmetic surgery in 1307 AD. Dr. Ali Ehsanloo is called the father of Iranian plastic surgery. Over the years, due to the increasing number of cosmetic surgeries in Iran, especially rhinoplasty, Iranian surgeons have become very skilled in various types of surgery. For example, a plastic surgeon in Europe and the United States performs only a few cosmetic surgeries per week, while in Iran, a plastic surgeon can perform up to 4 cosmetic procedures per day. This has caused foreign tourists to come to Iran and have their nose surgery performed by experienced Iranian doctors. According to the statistics, most health tourists are from the West Asia region, Central Asia, Europe, Australia, the United States, as well as Iranians living outside Iran. Other cosmetic surgeries that are very popular in Iran with experienced surgeons working in that field, we can mention cosmetic surgeries of the jaw, face, and teeth. This type of surgery is one of the most sensitive fields in beauty. In fact, maxillofacial surgery is a field in which specialists in general dentistry and its specialized courses pass and then perform oral maxillofacial surgery in specialty and subspecialty hospitals. The scope of activities in this field is very wide and includes treatment of head and face fractures, treatment of congenital anomalies of the head and face, treatment of benign and malignant lesions, treatment of infections, cosmetic facial surgery, and oral and implant surgeries. For example, a person who suffers from major injuries to the appearance of the face, jaw, cheeks, etc., as a result of a car accident or fall from a height, can be treated by experts of this field. The biggest goals of these doctors are treatment and reconstruction of body parts in the face and skull, in terms of efficiency and beauty. Due to the expertise of Iranian physicians in the field of oral medicine and also the high cost of treatment in other countries, many European, Australian, and American citizens, as well as Iranian citizens living abroad, tend to use the medical services of the Iranian physicians, and in addition to treatment, also visit the beauties of Iran. Dear listeners, we have reached the end of this program. Till next time, goodbye.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It's been described as an abortive act of piracy. The IRGC Navy has foiled a U.S. attempt to steal Iranian oil in the Sea of Oman. The U.S. military confiscated the Iranian tanker loaded with crude oil in the Sea of Oman, but why would the U.S. do that? Maybe it's because it does not want Iran to sell or deliver its oil to anyone. Well, Iran has been warning for years that the U.S. presence in the Persian Gulf is a source of instability. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the ramifications of this illegal act by the U.S.
We are conducting operation.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps released a video on Wednesday which showed how its naval force foiled a recent U.S. attempt to steal a shipment of Iranian oil in the Sea of Oman. The IRGC said the Americans seized a tanker and transferred its cargo to another vessel to divert it to an unknown destination. The IRGC forces, however, managed to land on the deck of the second tanker and diverted it into Iran's territorial waters. U.S. forces unsuccessfully attempted to block the tanker's path using helicopters and warships. They also made another failed attempt to seize the tanker from entering the Iranian waters. The ship later docked in Bandar Abbas port on October the 25th.
This is an American invasion, a hostile action against Iranian interests. This would definitely escalate the tensions, but the purpose of such moves is very much clear, as Iran has been practicing resistance diplomacy to resist against the United States pressures, illegal sanctions.
The U.S. has been trying to prevent Iran from selling its oil since former President Donald Trump pledged to bring the country's crude exports to zero. This toes the lines of the so-called maximum pressure campaign Trump launched in 2018 following his unilateral withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal. Last year, the Trump administration also threatened to deploy the U.S. Navy to the Caribbean Sea to stop Iran from delivering fuel shipments to Venezuela, but it failed to do so. Recently, when Iran began exporting fuel to Lebanon, the U.S. again vowed to impede the effort, but to no avail. Iran has time and again warned against U.S. adventurism in the West Asian region. Iranian officials say Tehran does not seek to get involved in a conflict with Washington, but will give a firm and crushing response to any military action. The recent confrontation in the Sea of Oman has highlighted Iran's military might and conveyed a message to the White House that the Iranian armed forces will not hesitate to defend the country and its interests.
Well, joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, we have Tim Anderson, Director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies. And also joining us is John Busnich, Journalist and Political Analyst.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, I'd like to welcome you both. Tim Anderson, let me first start with you and get your reaction to this U.S. provocation in the Sea of Oman and U.S.'s attempt to steal an Iranian oil tanker.
Well, basically, we're often talking about the same theme when we talk about so-called American sanctions, which is actually, in strict legal terms, just high seas piracy. The United States does not have the legal power to seize cargo between two sovereign states on the high seas. The United States, however, operates as if it were some kind of a high seas sheriff that's appointed itself to bounty hunt the economic products of countries that it wants to put under political pressure. Obviously, Iran has no reason to submit to this kind of high seas terror pressure, and is doing the right thing by continuing to conduct its independent trade policy.
But it's confusing as to why, A, the U.S. would feel that way, and B, why it would go to the extent that it did in terms of what happened today. I mean, when we take a look at the confrontational nature between Iran and the U.S., given obviously not only their past, but also in that strategic waterway. Doesn't it risk that escalating to an all-out war?
So I understand where you're coming from, because you're coming from the position of the average normal person who anticipates and who actually usually expects that two sides in a dispute both have legitimate interests at stake and are just arguing about the relative legitimacy of their interest. That is not the situation in this case. Naturally, Iran has its sovereign interests of conducting business internationally. However, the United States, and I often refer to it not as the United States, but as the Anglo-American Empire, is merely carrying on the tactics and the policies of the English Empire, which used this kind of provocation to encourage destabilization and to cause problems, allowing them to assert authority where there was none. And it's not a surprise that the Union Jack and the pirate flag, the Jolly Roger, were often stocked on the same boat, which in the daytime was serving as the English Navy ship, and at the nighttime was a pirate ship on the King's commission. This is no different from history, and I don't understand why people can't remember our most recent past and apply it to today's events. This is the main issue here.
Okay. Tim Anderson, welcome. Looking at what has happened, first, let me get an idea from you, your reaction as to what Iran has said was this effort for piracy from the U.S.
Yes, well, I don't want to speculate on what was really behind this particular incident. It's not clear yet from the information why they would have done this, except I want to comment on the current situation of the U.S., which I believe is in a time of uncertainty where there's a partial strategic withdrawal from the region going on.
Looks like we lost Tim Anderson. So let me turn to you, John Bosnich. So, Tim Anderson, if you're back with us, go ahead. Continue.
Sorry. So I was saying that at this time, there are certain changes happening in the Biden administration. And on one side, it has Israel with a fair degree of anxiety that the Biden administration may withdraw from the region. That's its main concern. And Israel has already, the Israeli leaders have already said to the Biden administration they should provoke Iran, they should go harder. Of course, Israelis don't want to do it themselves. They want the U.S. to carry out some sort of strike there. At the same time, the Biden administration has been talking about reverting to having its consulate in Jerusalem with a Palestinian brief, because they're trying to keep alive the myth of two states, which is important to keep the liberal Zionists in on the picture there. At the same time, they've withdrawn from Afghanistan. They're reconsidering their situation in Syria and Iraq. And so it's a time of uncertainty for the Biden administration. I think this act today really was a blow to the morale and the prestige of the U.S. military in the region. And I think that may have an impact on the uncertainty and the contemplation of a partial strategic withdrawal.
What would U.S. officials who have spoken on the condition of anonymity say that the Iranian report was not true and there had been no American attempt to seize a tanker, Tim Anderson?
Well, it's routine that they deny these sorts of things. I think that I've seen some video of what appears to be a pursuit, but I can't comment on the detail. But it's absolutely routine that the U.S. would deny these things. They denied, after all, that anyone was hurt in Al-Assad airbase strike in early 2020, and later on we heard there was more than 100 that had concussive injuries from that. So I wouldn't take that too seriously.
Okay, John Bosnich, our guest Tim Anderson talks about Israel and the U.S. and what Israel wants the U.S. to do, which is something that Israel is not going to do, and that is to have the U.S. provoke Iran and then get into a military engagement, which I'm assuming that Israel may follow through after the U.S. commits itself militarily to Iran. Both have made threats against Iran. How do you view that in the context of what happened today?
Well, I mean, in the context of bad events, one could take minimal reassurance in the fact that Israel does not feel that it could get away with making a unilateral attack on Iran and surviving the PR blowout as a result. So, to whatever extent it has any value, the slow movement on the part of the United States to do Israel's dirty work by bombing Iran or in other ways attacking Iranian interests is acting as a potential break to a much more severe conflict. And I do not see a coalition of the willing taking shape here. I do not see a clamoring on the part of other countries to assist the United States and Israel on this pressure against
Why
Iran. And I think that, I think that people have wisened up. After the war on Iraq for non-existent weapons of mass destruction, after identical unproven claims against Iran, after interventions in eastern Ukraine, in the Donbass region, I think that the American people are getting a bit tired of war without end and war without cause. War without cause. And it's revealing more and more that the wars are not made in the interests of the people of any country, but they are made in the interest of the war-driven economy, the military-industrial complex, which simultaneously owns the media that tells the people what to think. And this is all part of an ecosystem, and at today's time and date, Iran is the target. That's how the system works, unfortunately for all of us.
Tim Anderson, the U.S. is time and again said that we do not want nor will allow the Iranian oil to go out into the market, whether Iran is going to deliver it, sell it, or in any form. It has issued warnings against Iran on that, and we know that simply when it came to delivering oil to Venezuela, if you recall, and more recently to Lebanon. And this is under the sanctions that it has imposed, but also under that U.S. maximum pressure campaign. But we see that that sanction has been broken by Iran. Why does the U.S. insist to pursue that route when it has failed?
Well, you're right to point out that there's a great deal of continuity with the Biden administration and the Trump administration. In the Trump tore up the nuclear deal and proceeded into what he called this maximum pressure situation, which is effectively, of course, it's not sanctions at all. It's an economic siege. It's a blockade. It's grossly illegal. But, of course, those examples you mentioned, the oil to Venezuela, and Venezuela, by the way, its oil industry is recovering very strongly now as a result of that. The oil to Lebanon was not blocked. So the maximum pressure campaign might be there in words, but it's leaking very strongly. And remember that the U.S. had to create some new leaks in its campaign to allow the so-called Arab gas pipeline to come in as an alternative to Iranian oil from Jordan through Syria into Lebanon. So the U.S. was forced to back down in a number of those things. As I say, I think it's important because there is a strategic rethinking going on at the moment, which I believe began under the Trump administration, and Biden followed through with the withdrawal from Afghanistan. But the withdrawal from Afghanistan has consequences. It's weakened the U.S. hand against Iran, for one thing, because the Taliban, whatever we think of them, has worked to have a better relationship with Iran and a better relationship with China, and that's worked against U.S. strategic interests there. And Israel's relationship with the Biden administration is now under some strain. There's a fair degree of anxiety and shrillness coming from the Israeli side about what they would like to do. They'd like the U.S. to maintain its forces in the region when it's thinking to withdraw them, and they would like the U.S. to provoke Iran and do dirty work that the Israelis haven't got the stomach to do themselves.
John Bessage, I'm curious as to what the U.S. and Israel think when it comes to Iran's military might. I mean, you know, Iran is not the same Iran that it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, or even a few years back. There's been lots of advances that Iran has made in the military arena, from its naval capabilities to its air force to even its forces on the ground. I mean, the U.S. war on Syria, along with its allies, in a sense, helped Iran in terms of its role that it played in fighting the Daesh terrorists. Does that figure in their calculations when they see the way that Iran has increased its capabilities, including the way that it handled the situation today?
Indeed, it does work into their calculations, but it works into their calculations in two ways. Number one, they use it as grounds to claim more money from their government and from their taxpayers to even greater expand American military power. If you get out of your head the idea that the governments of the world work in the interests of all the people in every country in the world, and that there are governments that do not do that, and they work in the interests of special interests, then you realize that Iran's buildup of its self-defense mechanisms is used to buy more weapons in the United States. But on the second side of the same coin, it does make a difference in the region, especially insofar as Israel appears to no longer believe it has the independent capacity to strike out against Iran by itself. So Iran's defense buildup has had the dampening factor on regionally led strikes that draw the United States into a conflict. So this is a beneficial defensive advancement on Iran's side.
Tim Anderson, we do have to talk about the region itself, this Persian Gulf region, the strategic waterway of the Strait of Hormuz, where you have a lot of oil pass through it. Iran has time and again throughout the years stated that we can handle the security in the region, and Iran says that not just us, but to involve regional countries in West Asia to participate in establishing that security. And pointing to the U.S. as being a source of instability. If the U.S. is a source of instability, if you agree, then shouldn't the U.S. leave this region alone? It says it's in its plans to remove itself from West Asia, unless that's not the case.
Well, in an ideal world, of course, they should get completely out of West Asia. But I think in terms of the plan that they've been trying to pursue for the last 20 years at least, or a bit more really, they are realizing that there's a series of losing wars in which they're engaged, and the question is what to do about that. And the notion that I mentioned, the idea of a partial strategic withdrawal, which has been spoken of for at least 5 years in the US, and Trump tried a bit of it and didn't work, and Biden pursued it with the withdrawal from Afghanistan, the direct occupation withdrawal from Afghanistan. This all figures into a strategic positioning of the US, because of course let's remember they are also seriously overextended as regards China, so they're trying to maintain this barrier between Russia and Europe. They're fighting a series of losing wars in West Asia, and they're making these provocative steps against China and threatening a war over Taiwan. Now this is a serious overextension, and it's not that the US administrators are stupid. They will be aware of this, and they'll be thinking about ways in which to deal with it. And the way that they typically deal with it is to palm it off to their so-called partners, that is to say their subordinate characters in the region, and this is what's been spoken on in West Asia. They can say, if we withdraw from Syria and Iraq, we will allow Erdogan in the north and the Saudis to fight over control of Syria and Iraq. Supposedly that's still part of their game plan there, basically. The Israelis factor into that, and the Israelis, let's remember, are also in the Persian Gulf now. They're increasing their presence in the Emiratis. They're putting their media outfit into the UAE. They have a presence in North Iraq. They have a strong presence in Azerbaijan. In other words, Erbil on the edge of Iran and Azerbaijan on the north. There is an Israeli presence in the Gulf and in the north and the northwest of Iran now. So they'll be counting on that in a way to try and pursue whatever assets they have left in the region to carry on the work that they've failed to do in the last 20 years. And that, of course, includes Daesh, the ISIS, the version of Daesh that was set up and which they've been using in Afghanistan with terrible effects since they withdrew.
So what about that Council of the Willing, John Bostich? Is there a will on the countries in this region to really foresee that a war against Iran is going to benefit the region? I mean, a country like the UAE, shouldn't it think twice?
Yes.
Especially given that Israel has penetrated into its intelligence apparatus. Did the UAE foresee any of this happening? As an example.
Once again, we are getting into this same problem of presuming that political and economic colony countries actually think for themselves. They don't. They receive a set of instructions from the leader of their particular alliance, and they follow the instructions. If they want to not come under kind of political pressure first, then economic sanctions like the ones that have been pursued against Iran for decades, or eventually military intervention. And this is the way the world is run today. And more people are understanding this. And this is the important, hopeful way out. The more the public understands that wars are contrived to make profit and not created to defend national real interests in the region, the less likely it is that the United States can get any support from other countries except, of course, Israel. And that symbiotic relationship needs to come under more scrutiny, both in the United States and in Israel, because it's highly scrutinized now all around the rest of the world.
Thank you. We're going to end it there. That's John Busnich, journalist and political analyst from Belgrade. Tim Anderson, a pleasure, director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies from Damascus. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. It was great having you. Until next time, I'm Kavitah. We see you then.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Ladies and gentlemen and our dear brothers and sisters, I warmly welcome all our dear listeners to the show, Back to Reality, only on IRIB English Radio. Over here, we discuss few interesting topics which we can relate to our daily life. And I'm your host, Hassanain, and we have two special guests in our studio with us. Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, salam alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, thanks for inviting.
And Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi, salam alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure to have you brothers over here in our studio with us today. So without further introduction, let's just jump into our topic today and let's start our main discussion. So we're living in a world like modern world. It's 20th century in the year 2021, and where science has advanced so much. We get different people in our daily life, like religious people and some are scientific people. And what happens is sometimes, you know, the scientific people, they lead to a path there where they start believing that God doesn't exist. Is like, how can we explain science and religion can coexist?
Well, when we explain about how science and religion like they can coexist, first of all, we need to make sure that we know that there is no contradiction or the conflict between science and religion, especially when we're talking about Islam. Obviously, the contradiction or conflicts comes where either of them cannot answer the questions which were obviously asked from them. For example, we can see before Renaissance, the churches were unable to answer the questions which were raised by the scientists. There was a time when if someone would have said, like, the earth revolves around the sun, he was obviously killed or hanged till death. So that was the time when the religion or some religions who were unable to answer the questions that were raised by the scientists or the
because
advancement.
Because that's what science is meant to be. Like, science is a thing, like, they ask for proof.
Proof,
like, you say something, you claim something, they ask for the proof.
So when they were unable to answer these questions, obviously that was a hard time for the scientists, the human history. Whereas we do not see this case in Islam. Obviously we have big scientists who were the scholars, Islamic scholars. And on top of that, they were the father of many sciences, father of mathematics, father of algebra, I don't know, father of medicine, the other sciences as well. So we can see, like, even the father of chemistry was a Muslim scientist. And that Muslim scientist, the time when he was a scientist, he was also an Islamic scholar or preacher. So he studied in the regular Islamic schools. And on top of that, obviously, he had this knowledge. We recently had someone who passed away named as Ayatollah Hassanzadeh Amili. This is one of the renowned, well-known scholar in Iran who passed away recently. He had the title of Dhul Ilm. He possessed the knowledge, the sciences, basically. And he was a mathematician. He was an astronomer. He was a religious scholar. So, you know, there is no conflict or contradiction. I don't see any conflict or contradiction between science and the religion itself when we talk about the Islam. The only problem occurs where those who are not well-educated in the Islamic or in the religious field, and when they cannot answer the questions that are raised by the scientists, it does not mean that they should oppose them.
Let's stop here. Inshallah, we continue after a short break.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
And welcome to Back to Reality with my special guest, where we are talking about coexistence of science and religion. Sayyid Abdullah, do you think that all the religious beliefs we are having today, so, like, can we prove it to a people? Can we prove it to a non-religious person, like, through science or through intellect?
The idea is that when you say coexist, you mean there are two separate entities. There's science and there is religion. The fact is, they were never separated. They were, it's just the same. So if we look at Islam, for example, I don't want to look at pre-Islam. If you look at Islam, for example, Islam came with the religious laws and at the same time encouraged other sciences. For example, the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam says, seek knowledge from cradle to the grave. Yeah. Now, knowledge is a general word. It includes everything, right?
Yeah, it's a wasp.
Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he started this, he was